Hey folks, Ethan here with a quick but thrilling commercial interruption. On April 18th at 3 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern, we are hosting a masterclass on action geometry with the renowned Dean Rayburn. We host these masterclasses pretty much every third Thursday of every month. You don't want to miss them. You don't want to miss this one. This masterclass will be two extensive parts. Part one will dive into the basics of grand piano action geometry. You can master meticulous measurement techniques to determine radial arms, key ratios, and understand important calculations. In part two, you can apply your knowledge to real-world piano action problems. Dean demonstrates practical solutions, including the magic line concept and hammer weight reduction methods. Key features of this lecture include hands-on style learning with Dean Rayburn, a titan of the piano industry, in-depth coverage of action geometry principles and problem-solving techniques, real-world application through troubleshooting and solution demonstrations, and expert insights from Dean Rayburn. That's 45 years of experience in the piano industry. Dean is a seasoned RPT, certified tuning examiner, and a lifelong piano aficionado. With Dean, you are certainly learning from the best. So don't forget to sign up. Visit bit.ly/piano action for more details and secure your spot. That's bit.ly/piano action, bit.ly/piano action.
Hello, and welcome to Piano Tech Radio Hour, the weekly bridge to the future of the piano tech community. I'm David Anderson.
And I'm Ethan Janney. And we're here to ask great questions, and then we'll shut up and listen to some of the authorities, experts, and most outstanding personalities in our little world of pianos.
So, put on your best set of headphones, and let's get started.
So should we start, get the conversation started here, get the program started?
Absolutely.
All right. So we're going to have Daniel, our esteemed colleague here and member of Floating Piano Factory in New York City, read the bio for Steve, and then he'll tell you a little bit about Piano Technician's Master Classes quickly, and then we'll pretty much launch. And just before he does that, I want to thank all the people working behind the scenes. Pooja, we have Tal, we have Nikolai, we have Ian, we have Daniel, we have Patrick, we have Sarah. A lot of people working behind the scenes to make this happen. So thank you all very much for being a part.
Thank you so much. You make it seamless and beautiful. Thank you.
Yes. Can't do it without you. So yeah, go ahead. Hit it, Daniel, with our bio of our guest today, Steve Brady.
Hey, everyone. So Steve, our guest today, is an award-winning piano technician and respected PTG veteran. In 2012, he was included in the PTG Hall of Fame. In 2016, he was awarded the PTG's Golden Hammer Award, one of his profession's highest honors for his contributions in the piano industry. He's the author of Under the Lid, The Art and Craft of the Concert Piano Technician, and he resides in Seattle, Washington. And we're very happy to have Steve with us today. And I'd also like to let you know that the Piano Tech Radio Hour is being brought to you by Piano Technicians Masterclasses, an online educational resource that offers you cutting-edge instruction from piano industry masters without leaving your home. And you can find out more at www.pianotechniciansmasterclass.com/ptm2020.
Can I just jump in on the back of that for a minute?
Yeah, of course.
Biased contributor and supporter of Piano Technician's Masterclass. Ethan Janney, right here, up in the corner, is the only entity, Piano Technician's Masterclass, is the only entity in the world that's actually literally looking forward in the 21st century and providing high definition audio and broadcast quality video recordings for our community. And so I just want to give him huge props for that. The only entity, no other guild, no other organization of piano tuners, any place is really attempting to do that I know of. If I'm wrong, then please correct me with the data that I'm missing. But I just want to give props to Ethan and Piano Technicians Masterclass. I've had I don't know, half a dozen calls in the last 2 months about from technicians that have somehow gotten a hold of some of the recordings in the library, and they've called to sing the praises of how cool that is to just have that information in your computer that you can just look at and watch. It's amazing. Anyway, that's it. End of rant.
Thanks, David. And in the interest of our guests here, we'll jump right into the episode with Steve. And today's episode is going to be a very special, different thing we haven't done before. Ask me anything. You can ask Steve Brady anything. And if it's off limits, we'll just let you know. We'll bypass it. But I think pretty much everything's on the line. and we got some questions ahead of time. So maybe I'll jump in with the first one that I can there. And the first question was, perhaps someone could ask Mr. Brady if he knows what causes key leads to decompose into a white powder. It only happens, it kind of sounds like a mystery, like a Sherlock Holmes mystery. It only happens in some pianos and not others. I had a piano which only the black keys were affected. Others, only bass keys. Many thanks. And that's from Norman Brown. I don't know if Steve has an answer, but if he does, that'd be very interesting. What do you have, Steve?
Okay, well, first of all, is it just me or are other people experiencing breakups in the audio?
It's just you.
It's just you. We're doing pretty good.
Okay. Wow. Well, if it gets bad enough, I'll run and get my Ethernet cable and plug it into my computer.
Sounds good. We can hear you just fine, so you can
you
talk.
You can hear me? Okay, well, that's good.
You can talk your heart's content.
Okay, when I see this white powder on key leads, and sometimes it gets really extreme and it even makes the leads swell up, I've always assumed that it's some kind of oxidation. And technically, it turns out that if it's white, it's probably not an oxide of lead. It's another compound. Probably it's lead carbonate. Now, I'm not a chemist or anything, but there is a difference. Lead oxides are often used as pigments in paints, they used to be before we sort of outlawed that sort of thing. But true lead oxides tend to be yellow and orange and red. And lead carbonate is white, and that is used as a pigment in white paints. Okay, the difference is in what causes these compounds to form. Oxides, it's always oxidation, and that's mostly going to be from the lead getting wet or too much humidity. Lead carbonate is formed in the presence of carbon dioxide and humidity. I don't know if that really helps us understand why some keys, the leads develop this stuff and others they don't. For instance, why the black keys would do it and the white keys wouldn't. As far as that goes, there may be some other agent that's acting on the lead. For instance, maybe if the leads on some of the keys, like the black keys, are sealed with a different compound, it might react with the lead differently. I don't know. And as to why it would just be the bass keys, it's anybody's guess. But the one thing you can really control is the humidity. And the less humidity, the less likelihood there is of developing these compounds on lead. I hope that helps.
Steve, if you come upon this issue and the leads are either expanded out or white powderish, what is your protocol for mitigation?
It depends on how bad they are. If it's just kind of a light dusting, I might try to seal the lead with a spray lacquer or something. If they're really bad, to the point I've seen them where the leads expand so much that
they bind the keys.
They start splitting the keys even.
Yeah.
In that case, you take them out.
Yeah.
And put in new leads, because there's really not much else you can do.
Well, I've heard about people, you know, Dremeling them down and then putting epoxy or some kind of, you know, permanent kind of sealant in there. But you're right. If they're growing and splitting and rubbing and binding, best thing to do is just knock the lead out of there and put it.
I think it's probably faster than trying to grind them down and seal them and stuff.
Plus, you know, you're exposed to toxic stuff when you're grinding lead. Ethan, next question.
Sure, let's hit the next one. Okay, heading back here. Also, we'll try to put the link in the chat later. It'd be great to have some advance notice of that kind of thing, but there's a Spanish language sort of online lecture coming up in an hour, so we'll try to put that link in and give you guys that opportunity to check that out. Okay, next question. I would like to have a discussion on how to deal with loose tuning pins, especially in the bass section. Sounds like a specific piano is using as an example was kept in a poor environmental conditions for several years in an open veranda in a hotel with a wet inland breeze blowing towards it. An event organizer has purchased a piano and is now kept inside a hall under good conditions. Unfortunately, I have noticed that several tuning pins are getting loose. Can we take up this issue in our discussions?
Yeah, well,
and that's from Clement Kanji, and he's on an island nation in the Indian Ocean. I know he has tons of problems with humidity.
So he's had huge swings in humidity, I guess.
Yeah,
for sure.
Or just overwhelmingly high humidity all the time, probably, I would imagine.
But then for the pins to get loose indicates that the humidity may have gone the other way, too. Well, okay, so it depends on how loose the pins are. I mean, if they are so loose that they don't even come close to holding, you replace them. And you really want to check out the pin block and make sure that there's no cracks in it. Tip-offs about cracks in the pin block or delaminations would be that you have a bunch of tuning pins all in one area that are loose, like right next to each other, or they're all in a straight line. That's a real tip-off. But if you're not getting that, and say they're just barely holding or barely not holding, I don't think there's a better quick solution than CA. The CA glue, very thin, like water thin CA. You can drip it in there. And the beautiful thing about it is, even if there are some little cracks, it will tend to seep in and seal them. Whereas, you know, in the old days, we used to, if we had a few loose tuning pins, we would put in oversized pins just on those. And if there's any cracks, you know, it's just going to make them worse. Mm-hmm. So I really like the CA for that. You know, if it's really extreme and it's throughout the whole piano, the obvious solution is to put in a new pin block. But I know that budgets don't always allow for that. So, but the CA is quick, easy. It's so much better than the old pin block restorers, they used to call them, that would just gunk up the pin block and the tuning pin feel would get bad. With the CA, you don't have that problem.
There's been technicians in the United States that have been using CA for just that purpose for a quarter century, and have followed those pianos. And there's literally, I mean, you can't say never because perfection doesn't exist, but hardly ever a failure or any issue at all. And all you have to do is Google CA glue piano and you get everything you need. There's technicians that have been doing it for a long time, and they'll tell you exactly how to do it.
Yeah. And so, but it's the water thin variety that you want to use so that it really penetrates well.
Yes, wicks.
And what I do is just, I'll use a hypo oiler and just, you know, put in drops at the base of the tuning pin as far from the string itself as I can get. And you do it slowly and watch. And when the hole around the tuning pin appears to be filling up, then you're probably good. Okay, next.
Next question.
I'm just going to add a quick follow-up because I've seen a little bit of this. I don't really hear anybody talking about it. Want to know if you think it's a bad idea or it's just something, you know, that's not optimal. But I hear some people putting something, they actually remove the tuning pit and put something else in there, like a, I've heard like a sandpaper, or there's even some sort of like gridded up material that you could put in there. Is that kosher? Or have you seen any experience?
This is old school too. You know, we all used to do that in the old days. But again, if you shim a hole and there happens to be any cracking at all, you're just going to make that worse over the long haul. So I don't use a lot of CA glue in my work because I've developed a sensitivity to it and it causes respiratory problems. But I got to tell you, this is the one thing I do use it for.
Oh.
I would say I also use it for hairline cracks around bridge pins. But when I do it, I wear a respirator. Because
good to know.
I have trouble for several days afterwards. Someone else had talked about, why not just tap the pins further into the pin block? The reason that's not the best solution is because what you're doing is just tightening the pin up at the very bottom. And it's going to affect the tuning pin feel, and it's not going to last that long. It's kind of the only time I would do this is if I'm in the field, I don't have any water thin CA with me, and I've got some pins that just aren't holding. It's like they're just barely not holding. Then you can tap them in, but you want to support the pin lock when you do that. And then come back later with CA.
Oh.
Thank you.
We need to ask the next question, but I want to encourage everybody in the sound of my voice. I'm challenging you to ask the question maybe you're afraid to ask, or a question that has been bothering you for a long time and you don't know the answer, but you're kind of shy of saying it. Ask it. And this is, we have a priceless opportunity here with somebody that's been doing this for way longer at a way higher level than most of us. And it's really a tremendous opportunity to get showered with information. That's it.
Okay. David asked, he says he agrees about using a respirator and he wants to know what sort of respirator I use. So I'm just going to run into the shop and bring it back and show you.
Cool.
That's cool. Cause there's a few more comments here too. I can just read from Cy Schuster. He said, if you use a hypodermic Dinal to apply it carefully, okay, keep a q-tip handy to stop trips or else you can glue a damper to the string. Don't ask me how I know.
Okay, this is my respirator.
Wow, that was quick, Steve.
Well, my shop is right next door to my office.
It makes you look so, like a huge insect. It's
awesome. it does, you know. But it seems to solve the problem of the fumes.
Wow. You know? So you don't feel messed up for 2 days afterwards when you use the respirator? Okay?
No.
Awesome.
Someone else asked about pin tight. They say it's more popular in Europe in comparison to CA glue. Ooh. Pin tight is a very old formula. I have never used it myself, so I can't really speak to that with authority, but I do know that one of the ingredients in pintide is potato juice.
Hmm.
Whatever.
So just go straight to the source.
Have you ever seen a piano treated with Pintite? It's horrific.
Mm. I tried it a few times. It I didn't seem so spectacular, but it's greasy. Again, it's just a couple nasty. Times.
It's nasty. That's just complete ignorance. My
Paul is asking about loose bridge pins with CA. I do use it on bridge pins if they're at all loose. You can apply it with the strings on, but you just have to be really careful. Put one drop at a time at the base of the bridge pin on the side opposite from the string. And it does help with false beats. It also improves the tone. So if you're trying to get stronger tone, a clearer tone, it's good for that.
Especially in the top three octaves. Especially in the top three.
Especially.
Adds noticeable system if the pins are loose and then you tighten them up. And this is why I agree with Cy Schuster. You need I could never get the piano commercial house hypo oilers to get fine enough for me. I use a disposable large bore syringe, and I'm just it's so much more controllable for me, for my crazy hands. So that's my suggestion. Buy a whole bunch of them, and it's like 12 cents a piece.
Mm-hmm. Are these like insulin syringes?
Yeah, big, large bore needles.
Large bore needles, yeah.
Large bore needles that well can be any size you want, but just get big bore needles. Not huge, but so that you can spend about two times and your hand will remember, this is the amount of pressure I need for one beautiful drop. And you'll never have a problem again.
Yeah, for years I used a veterinary syringe. It was a glass syringe, with a large bore needle, and that finally it broke. But now I have one. I think I got at the woodworking store. It's a very large syringe with a large bore needle, and it works great.
That's right, and you can just order them online by the box, so no problem.
I saw Paul. I think it's Paul Williams. I'm not sure what the first name is, but he said he was holding something up to the screen there.
So. Yeah, Paul Williams.
Well, that's a hypo oiler.
It's got a hypo oiler.
Yeah. That for my hands, it's not specific enough. God bless you, Paul, for being able to use that accurately. I can't. The one drop thing. That's what I use for one drop voicing on hammers too, just when I want to plink, 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 each one of the strike points.
Ed Whitting is asking me what brand and model my respirator is. It's MSA. MSA. And I don't see a model number, but the cartridge looks like 1814.
Sounds helpful. Now that we have the internet, kind of thing's pretty easy. By the way, I just wanted to say, because Paul was showing some things, I had some comments from people earlier in the feedback forums. They were like, when they're doing the Zoom call and it's jumping around from speaker to speaker, or it gets it kind of confusing. So you can actually, if you're on Zoom with us, then you can choose in your settings who you view. If you want to click on one of the people, you can pin their video so you can see exactly what they're doing all the time. Or you can choose speaker view in the upper right-hand corner. You can also choose grid view where it shows everybody. But just to know, you do have some flexibility here if you're in the Zoom call. And if you're there out on Facebook or YouTube, we just send, we have one of our, actually Daniel's our sort of camera angle man, and he tries to show you the best image of what's going on here. So we've got some added features here you can enjoy. I'm going to move on to another question from the past, and then we'll start moving on to questions that came in during the session. Thanks to the people who submitted questions ahead of time. This actually really makes, you can do this at any, for any of our sessions. It really makes it easier to make an agenda and cover exactly what you want to hear.
Yeah, so this question, thank you very much, folks.
Yeah. This question was from
for thoughtfulness.
Definitely. And proactivity is useful. David Lilledahl, I hope I pronounced that correctly. He says, hi, Steve. String leveling in the field. Is there an oral red flag that alerts you to check this out? Your favorite tool and procedure? And that's from David Lilledahl.
Okay.
Great question.
That's a great question. Yes, there is an oral red flag. And you know, once you've identified it, you hear it very easily. But it, you know, you have to listen to the sound in a very specific way. But the way I describe the red flag sound is the note is both weak and twangy. Those two things. It's weak and twangy. If it's just weak, it's probably not a problem with, and I have to say, when we say string leveling, there's two reasons why you get this problem. One is that the strings are not level with each other, but the other one is that the top of the hammer is not level. And the resulting sound is the same for both conditions. So you first have to determine if it's a string leveling problem or a hammer leveling problem. So, yeah, but anyway, you need to listen very specifically. And where you find this problem the most tends to be in the tenor section. And I think it's because everything is angled there. The A graphs are angled, the strings are angled, the hammers are angled. But I'm always super careful in the tenor section to get all of the hammers mated to the strings. I'll show you some tools I like to use.
Ooh, show and tell. This is exciting.
This is fantastic, literally. I can't believe we're doing this. This is...
By the way, we have one of Steve's Piano Texture's masterclasses lectures is on tools, and it's really cool. He has a vintage toolkit that he picked up somewhere, and he kind of brings out all of these ancient tools and, you know, talks about this story of how he figured out what the heck they did and stuff like that. That was pretty fun.
If you want to go to piano technology graduate school, like small group doctoral things, check out Mr. Brady's Piano Technician's Masterclass.
Yeah, good stuff.
Okay. So this is the first tool I like to use. And this is for leveling strings. And it's basically a float.
Wow, is that Charlie Falk's tool?
Yes, this is Charles Falk's tool for leveling strings. It is so much better than a bubble level. The bubble level, the problem is you're trying to level the strings to the floor or to the earth or whatever. And the problem with that is there are areas in the piano where you are not going to be able to do that, and or areas where you shouldn't do that, because you're going to be forcing things. So recognize that the string plane is crowned. Mm. And this is because the plate casting is crowned. So the beauty of this tool is that it rests on the adjacent strings. And if there's any crowning at all, and the tool tilts to accommodate that. Oh, I love nice. This tool. So Charles Falk, okay, he has another tool that the nice thing about this tool, see if I can get you to see the end of it. Okay.
There you go.
So it has a groove in the end, and you can either lift a string with this, or if a string is high, you can actually lower it, push it down, because it provides its own leverage. I would say use this tool with caution. I normally use a string hook, and I'm raising the strings rather than lowering them. But there are occasions where I'm trying to raise the two low strings and they won't raise high enough. And then the only thing you can do is lower the high string. And with, you know, with a regular string hook, that's impossible. Or with just a tool that will push down, you can't lower a string. But with this tool, you can. So I use it sparingly, only when absolutely necessary. And the reason I say that is because if you move the string down more than just a little bit, you'll be able to see a little kink in the string. I've never been able to hear a difference as a result of that kink, but I don't like the way it looks. So again, use it very sparingly, but when you need this tool, it is the only thing that works. Mm. Okay.
Can you tell us what is your preferred kind of string hook?
Yeah. Let's see here. You can't actually buy this anymore, but I've had mine forever. And there's a guy in Colorado named Glenn Hart who makes the best string hook ever.
That's right. It's such a drag that it's not being made.
Yeah. And it's made out of a single piece of mild steel that he has bent into this shape. So the handle is here. The hook is here, and it's very slender. Mm-hmm. So it can get in between the strings. And at the other end, you've got a tool for pushing the string down, like just to seat it on the bridge, like this. I love this tool. And Glenn told me he stopped making them because a few people were too energetic with them and they would break the tip off, because he has hardened the tip a little bit. And
But
I have had mine for decades and I've never broken it. I love it.
That's an ignorance and education issue.
Yeah. I think you're right.
If you're pulling that hard, you're that's a huge red flag.
Yeah. Well, and I think that the key is it's not so much how hard they're pulling, it's that they'll put it in between the strings and turn it and snap off the very tip.
Jeez.
So you just have to use some care. You know, all tools need to be used with care. Okay, now if we've determined that the strings are level, how do we deal with the other end? That's the hammer. And my favorite tool for this is a curved sand file. These are homemade. But the beauty of the curved sand file is that you don't have to take, you know, a straight file and be kind of getting down to the side of the hammer and making sure that everything's curved. And this is a lot more work. And the beauty of this tool is it's idiot proof. You don't go like this over the hammer. It's not like this. You go like this. And the curvature of the tool itself maintains the curvature on the top of the hammer. It's a beautiful tool, and it's so fast. You know, you can just, in two or three strokes, you can level a hammer up.
Wow.
So I highly recommend this. I think I once measured the radius of this curve, and I can't remember how big it was, but it's obviously a lot bigger than the top of a hammer. But the reason it works is it cuts when you reach this point in the stroke and this point. So it maintains a proper curve on top of the hammer.
Wow.
Love this tool.
This is a whole class. This is a whole doctoral, you know, class on getting things level, man. What?
So I have two that I use a lot. One has, I think this is something like 320 grit, and the other one is 500 grit. And it works great. So
you're just lightly going over the top of the piano that with a really super light touch, right? Right over the top. The flat part and the curved part, everything.
Yes. Straight line. I'm not trying to do this. It's straight line, in and out, in and out.
And you're just lightly following the contour of the hammer. You're not, there's no pressing or anything like that, right?
Yeah. No, if you're just trying to level out the top of the hammer, there's no need to take off a lot of felt.
Right.
And in many cases, especially with hard-pressed hammers, I just go with the 500 grit. The soft-pressed hammers, sometimes I need a little, a little stronger grit to do those. So I start with the 320 and then finish with the 500.
So everybody wants to know, then what is your final method of checking the hammer to string mating? You pluck strings, how do you force the hammer to the strings, all that
stuff? Oh, okay. I'm glad you asked that.
By the way, I just put in both of Steve's, links to both of Steve's lectures on piano technicians and master classes. I remember correctly, he shows how to use many of these tools and demonstrates these tools in maybe some of them in both lectures. And at least the art of voicing, he does some of these voicing tools and the filing tools and things like that.
Okay, so bringing the hammer to the string and blocking it. I can use all different methods, and I've gotten pretty good at doing it with just rocking the jack and pushing the hammer up into the string. But you know, the action has to be in really close regulation for that to work.
That's right.
The problem with a string hook for me is that I always lose it in my case. I have a hard time finding it, and it's just one more tool to juggle. So what I've been doing lately, do you know this tool?
No.
This is the Fazioli style between the strings voicing tool.
I have one of those. Sorry, my glasses weren't on. That's a good tool.
I love this tool for many reasons. One is that since the business end is so slender, you can actually see what you're doing down there between the strings. Whereas, you know, a traditional chopstick tool, the tool itself is so thick, sometimes it hides.
Right, 3-4 times as thick as that.
Yeah, it hides the point of attack and you can't see it. So I just discovered that I can use this to just kind of poke the front of the hammer and lift it up to the string. It saves so much time to only be using one tool.
And you don't have to make a hook or change anything. You just, wow.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. That's
this has been my go-to tool for fine voicing between the strings and also bringing the hammer up to the strings to block it. So that's it. So you step on the sostenuto pedal, first the damper pedal, or no, you play the note, step on the sostenuto pedal, and then just raise the hammer up and pluck the strings.
Perfect. I have another question from before the lecture, and then if we need to, we'll move on to things that came up in the chat here. The question is from Greg Lynch, and it is Steve Brady. He would like to know, in your career, how many vertical pianos have you performed full regulation and voicing procedures? That's a great question.
That is a great question. For me, actually, the answer is I can probably count the number of verticals that I have fine regulated and voiced on the fingers of one hand. The main reason being that I just don't work on that many verticals. So Yeah, I have certainly done the process with a few, but you know, the guy to ask about this is Fred Sturm.
No kidding.
Fred is a great technician, and he has protocols for, you know, doing fine hammer fitting and voicing on vertical pianos. You know, he has the whole thing mapped out. But and in fact, I've used some of his ideas on the rare occasions where I've had to do that with a vertical.
Cool. I'll throw in that I've done a handful of upright regulations, and I definitely do voicing. That was the other part of the question. I think voicing on uprights, that came up in the lecture with Boaz Kirschenbaum. He highly recommends, you know, just doing voicing on every piano, at least a little bit, whether it's something you're just testing something out, or, you know, a small thing that you can do to sell the customer on. One thing about voicing is the client notices, you know, after you do it a lot of times. So it's kind of a nice way to send them off, and actually can make your tuning sound better. On almost any piano. So I've done some voicing on uprights. That's in New York City, you know, and a bit in Chicago. So I think people are inclined to have smaller pianos. And so I mean, they'd be willing to do that work on the smaller pianos because they have to have them in the small quarters. But yeah, also upright regulation, you can really achieve a lot. You can make these pianos a lot better than they are. A lot of uprights are neglected, and they have a lot more potential than people that own them realize. If you could show them, they'll just be so tickled, you know.
That's right. And Fred Sturm is a master of the vertical piano. Jim Busby is also the a master. Vince Mercolo is also a master of the vertical piano. If you contact any of these men, they'll be more than happy to give you their protocols or to guide you to someplace where you can read them or copy them.
Yeah, and I think some of these have appeared in the journal. I know Fred published a great article on doing fine regulation and voicing on uprights. It was a while back.
That's exactly right. Bill Monroe, a younger generation guy, is really good. Really, really a great technician. Has a published series of articles about how to deal with vertical issues, and he's fantastic. So there's a lot of education out here, ladies and gentlemen.
And also, you know, when we'll put the feedback form in the end, if that's something people are interested in, an upright regulation class on Piano Technicians Master Classes, if we got enough interest, I think that's a very interesting topic, I think. I'm gonna jump back here a little bit, make sure we pick up some things in the chat previously. First of all, there was a little bit of discussion, we didn't call it out in our conversation here, of the CA glue, that there's actually some odorless types of CA glue, and there's something called Super Gold, which said they get it online from Central Hobbies in Billings, Montana, so that sounds interesting. And then I'll jump to this question from Patrick Drain. Thanks for joining us, Patrick. Question for Steve. I'll be spending some time with a customer's 1986 Steinway L next week. Customer is complaining about, and I've noticed, very poor checking. What is your checklist of procedures to optimize this on the vintage of Steinway & Sons? I'm planning on repinning repetition levers as a first step. Other aspects to look at?
Yeah, you know, that checking can be really hard on Steinways from that period. One problem is that the hammer tails are too short in relation to the height of the back check. So one method I've used to improve that is to actually raise the back check. You know, and this all goes along with Steinway's issue with sometimes the string, the plane of the strings is too high in relation to the action. So all of these things kind of feed into the problem, but I have gotten improvement fairly cheaply and easily just by raising the back check, the heads of the back checks as much as possible within reason.
Can you tell us your protocol for that?
I use a hammer, like a vertical piano hammer extractor, you know. So you can set that up so that it bears against the bottom of the back check head and just do this.
And get a little jig, piece of wood or something to put on the bottom to anchor it and then push up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that it does the job very easily.
Yeah. I think Ed McMorrow has a method where he uses needle-nose pliers and vice grips and kind of like, you know.
Yeah, like that works too.
Up, little by little, you know.
Yeah.
Those short tails, you only need like a couple of millimeters further up to get it.
Right, right. Another issue that you sometimes run into on those is the bevel angle of the back check is wrong. So you check the bevel angle by playing the hammer into check and then push, while it's in check, push the hammer down and see what happens. Does it get way harder as you push it down? Like the point you can't push it down any harder, then that means the back check is probably laid back too much. It needs to be brought forward a little bit. And that's the most common problem with bad checking, you know, due to bevel angle, is that the angle is too great.
So
what happens in effect is that the tail of the hammer hits the back check and kind of bounces out. Those are two suggestions that I could offer. Raise the back check and check the bevel angle.
Perfect.
Beautiful.
I'll move on to the next. Really great questions today. Thank you, folks. I mean, really, this is great to have good questions. And so we've had previous episodes where maybe it's a little thin on what people want to interact, and maybe people are shy, but I just love all of the information you're asking for here. This one looks like an anonymous question because I can't tell who the user is, but it says, what is your opinion of the effect of using some now popular non-Steinway hammers on an American Steinway piano? For example, Abel Natural Wool, Dirty Hammers, Ronson Weichert Felt, Renner Blue Point. What do you gain? What do you lose?
Okay, that's a good question.
Awesome.
And I've tried most of these hammers on Steinways over the years. I will say that right now, my hammer of choice when I'm rebuilding Steinway action is going to be the New York Steinway hammers. I feel like there's a sound you can get with them that you can't get with other hammers. Having once rebuilt a piano for a client and having used another brand of hammers, and then years later having had the client complain about it, you know, that they weren't genuine Steinway parts, I've gotten very careful. And, you know, I will only use non-Steinway hammers if the customer insists. Having said that, I love Weichert Special Felt hammers, both the ones made by Ronson and also the ones made by Renner. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the Blue Points. Is that
that's correct?
Yeah.
That's correct.
And I take care of pianos that have both kinds on, and they're wonderful. Probably my favorite sounding hammers of all. But I like those. What do you gain? I think you gain a longevity of voicing. They tend to hold their voicing really well. What do you lose? That's a harder question. You probably do have some loss in power. But, you know, I think that these things are mutable. You can, if you don't have enough power, you can always solve that with hardeners. So I don't think there's a huge difference, but I have to say I enjoy New York Steinway hammers. I enjoy the Weichert Special Felt hammers of both kinds. After that, I have also used the dirty felt,
ABBA.
Natural felt. I've used that a lot on all kinds of pianos, and I love those hammers too. I think they sound great. But I think the bottom line is, where are your voicing skills?
Oh.
Because if your voicing skills are great, it almost doesn't matter what kind of hammers you're using.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So
sounds like a good place to end on that. Yeah. On that note, should I move on to the next question here? Or got any follow-ups, David?
Just 15 seconds.
Yeah.
This is really the challenge. Mr. Brady, this incredible master, is challenging everybody that's here to raise your voicing skills. They who have the best skills wins in our craft. So listen.
And going back to something Ethan said earlier, I try to do a little voicing on every piano I tune. And I would say almost without exception, I will do what I call spot voicing.
Yes.
I'll find maybe the three notes that stick out the most to me, one way or the other, whether they're too soft or too low, too bright. And I'll voice them very quickly. It does make a difference in the final product. Plus, it gives you practice in voicing. I've been having a lot of fun in the past year or so with some of David's methods. I like the tunnel of air.
Yeah.
And I find that works especially well on verticals, because the hammers are so accessible.
That's right.
And so quick. And it just really improves the sound. But I like the other method too, of doing I can't remember if you had a name for that, of just kind of going sort of like angel shot.
Right, along the edge of the sacred area, like right. A steeple. Yeah, and feeling the felt, using a fairly long needle, 11 millimeters, and just feeling it, acupuncturally kind of feeling it. If it's soft, you're good. If not, you soften it up and then come back up and it's the less strokes that you take, the better it is for the hammer. Isn't that correct, Steve?
Exactly. And that's one reason why the longer I'm in this business, the more and more I find myself gravitating towards voicing methods that use a single needle.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yep. Okay, let's move on.
Yes.
All right, next question. Yeah, we've got a lot of good stuff in here. From Donna Bird. I'm not sure what this means, but maybe you'll know. Steve, are the hammers you were referring to with your special set back in the piano? And if so, are you pleased with their tone? I saw your video on the university tech session. Do you know what she's talking about?
No.
Okay, let's just skip it. All right, now I think we're jumping on to potentially newer questions that came into the chat. Let's see here. We got the non-Steinway hammer question. Have you guys seen anything else popping in here? Advice. One thing I will call out in the meantime is just to say, voicing has just come up as a recurring theme over and over again. I can give this perspective as someone who's like looking at what people want from the piano industry, looking at people are a little bit afraid to do, something that requires, for better or for worse, kind of trial and error learning and developing your own ear. But to me, it's becoming more and more clear that that's something that the technicians of the future are going to have to get good at. Tuning's the basics, and then voicings is really the next level skill that you need to be a great piano technician. And yes, but get over the fear is probably a common theme, and that came up in some other lectures
that we, or just even some radio hours that we did, just general fears of trying things out.
Right.
And it's a, yeah, go ahead, David.
Well, this is, I'm going to shill a book. My little sister is a very successful business consultant and author. And she wrote a little book, cheap and good, on Amazon called Be Bad First. Her name is Erica, E-R-I-K-A Anderson. And this book is like, gives you the freedom to fail, to try stuff. You're never going to be good at it at first. So you got to be bad first and just kind of look at it. Reshift your context about what failing is and what being bad first is. It's the way you are with everything. Face reality. You have to be bad first, and then you're going to get good really quickly. And don't let fear prevent you from going to the high end of this craft, because it does. And they who have the most skills gets to make way more money and have way more self-respect and peer respect. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, just to integrate from our most, from our recent lecture with Carl Lieberman, just about charging appropriately and so on and so forth. I don't think a lot of technicians realize that how special that voicing skill is. I mean, look around at your fellow technicians. How many of them kind of know what they're doing or have a lot of questions around it? If you're the one that's investigating, you're the one that's testing and making trials and errors, becoming good at it, you all should probably feel totally fine about charging appropriately for that. It's a specialized skill. Again, that as I look around at the general landscape of piano technicians, very, very few piano technicians actually can do it. So it means if you can, that's why it's worth charging for. It's a higher value, because not just anyone can jump in and do some voicing on a piano.
I ask piano technicians and very successful piano sellers all over the country. I'm in touch with a lot of people. And I said, what's the percentage of piano technicians that can really, you know, take a piano, that final, what, Steve, 5%, 10%, whatever it is, that can really make a piano sing, maximize its efficiency as an instrument? And they say, the highest anybody ever gives me is 10%.
Wow. So yeah, I believe it. We, I want to just say, we put a link. Thank you, Pooja, for adding that. And there's a feedback link. It's all a bunch of text in a note that was put in here. There's a feedback link if you want to add some feedback. There's a link if you want to sign up for a pretty affordable way of signing up for Piano Technicians Masterclass. It's $39 a month is our lowest price. Cancel anytime. And that link is in there. Also, felt like adding a few links to Steve Brady's individual lectures. So you can access those too with the subscription, but you can purchase them individually if you like what he has to share today. And I'll just move on to the next question. And then maybe that's the last question. Does that sound good, guys? Yeah?
Yeah, just okay. Leave Steve a couple of minutes to just wrap up.
Yeah.
Home, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Let me do this question because it's here, and then we'll wrap up. How would you add friction to balance rail key bushings? Previously, a tech inserted a hot iron to compress the bushings and reduce friction, but did too much. Piano was then stored on its side for 4 years, further compressing the felt. Thanks. Any tips on adding friction to balance rail key bushings?
Well, that's a good question. And I would imagine that there's some noise involved with bushings that are compressed that much. I had an experience maybe 20 years ago with noise in key bushings that had just gotten compressed from playing. This happened to be on my wife's Falcone, the 7'4" Falcone. And we were hearing a noise in the action. It sounded sort of like the noise you get with hard knuckles. But it wasn't hard knuckles, I checked. Finally traced it to the key bushings. If I moved them side to side a little bit, I heard this little clicking noise. And her piano was only about 5 years old at the time. So I thought, well, I don't want to rebush the keys, so let me try something else. So I took a single needle voicing tool, sort of like this one. Oh, and by the way, someone asked, can you buy these from Fazioli? I don't know, but I bought mine from Jürgen at
Piano. Right. Pianos Forte Supply has them.
So I used the needle to just, I had the action apart, the keys off the keyframe, and I could see kind of a little half round place where the cloth had gotten compressed. I just went down the middle of the cloth to kind of poof it back out. And I did it on every one. Wherever I saw this little sort of divot, I just ran the needle right down the middle of the cloth in that place. And it took care of the noise. It tightened the key bushings up a lot. So now this is kind of my go-to method for, you know, a piano that's not too old and yet has some problems with loose key bushings and noise. And the really extraordinary thing about this is I never had to do it again. And she kept the piano for another 25 years.
Wow.
Don't ask me why.
That one tip is worth 3 hours.
So I call this procedure rejuvenating the key bushings.
Oh my God.
Another method you can use if you happen to have the action in the shop is to use VS Profelt from Piano Tech Supply. And you put that, you put your key bushing calls into the mortises first, but not all the way. And then you use a little syringe to just put a couple of drops on each bushing. And when you've done that, you push the calls in all the way, and this will resize the key bushings to the proper dimensions. And it should take care of the problem too.
Wow. Awesome.
So the clock on the wall says,
we're right. Overtime.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, Steve, just give us a minute on how you enjoyed yourself this hour and what it meant to you and just anything you want to say, brother.
This was a lot of fun. I mean, I feel like I'm just getting started. But I see a lot of questions that maybe haven't been answered yet. But maybe
we should do it again.
Yeah, well, there's no question.
I'd be happy to. It's a lot of fun. It's fun to see all of these faces too.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Hi, Carl.
And
hi, Sheila.
I know.
Hans Krebs. Hi, Donna Bird, Linda Kay, Paul Williams, and Carl. And this is on the first page.
No, it's a nerd village. It's awesome.
It is a nerd village. Yeah, I'm so happy to be one of you.
Thank you, awesome. Brother. This was precious. Thank you so much, Steve.
And I think that the great thing here is that, you know, we're all improving our craft. Sai is holding up my book.
There you go.
Thanks for the plug.
Automatic shills, nice. Steve. Nice. That's how badass you are. You have automatic shills. That's
But it's so great, you know, that we're all here trying to improve our craft, and it's a lifelong thing.
That's exactly.
You never stop learning.
Perfect.
Mr. Jess.
Great words to sign off on.
If you stop learning, you're dead in the water. I'll tell you that.
Yes, words to sign off on.
Okay.
Very cool. Well, thank you, everybody, for attending, especially thank you to David Anstrin, and of course, Steve Brady. And again, thank you to all the people helping out with us behind the scenes. We've got Pooja and Tal and Ian and Mikolai and Daniel and Pat and Sarah. And Joe was even helping out for a while. He had to move back to Israel during this whole crisis, whatever. But yeah, thanks to everyone helping out behind the scenes. Thanks for you guys coming here, adding your questions, being dedicated, being engaged. We're all connected as a team. We're working together to make things better and
improve our craft. So thank you. Everybody's an integral ingredient. All right. We'll start signing it off on everything.
Next week.
Yeah. We'll see you next week. Talk to you later.
Thank you so much for giving us an hour of your time. Remember that you can catch us live online every Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time.
That's right. Go to pianotechradio.com to register so you can interact live and ask questions of our guests.
See you next week.
Hey, folks. Ethan here with a quick but thrilling commercial interruption. On April 18th at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, 6 p.m. Eastern, we are hosting a masterclass on action geometry with the renowned Dean Rayburn. We host these masterclasses pretty much every third Thursday of every month. You don't want to miss them. You don't want to miss this one. This masterclass will be two extensive parts. Part one will dive into the basics of grand piano action geometry. You can master meticulous measurement techniques to determine radial arms, key ratios, and understand important calculations. In part two, you can apply your knowledge to real-world piano action problems. Dean demonstrates practical solutions, including the magic line concept and hammer weight reduction methods. Key features of this lecture include hands-on style learning with Dean Rayburn, a titan of the piano industry, in-depth coverage of action geometry principles and problem-solving techniques, real-world application through troubleshooting and solution demonstrations, and expert insights from Dean Rayburn. That's 45 years of experience in the piano industry. Dean is a seasoned RPT, certified tuning examiner, and a lifelong piano aficionado. With Dean, you are certainly learning from the best. So don't forget to sign up. Visit bit.ly/piano action for more details and secure your spot. That's bit.ly/piano action, bit.ly/piano action.